hope it will continue to be so. I'm really very impressed with what's going on here, and I think your people accomplish so much, and the openness to continue growing and hearing new ideas, or maybe reviewing old ideas and putting them in a different perspective, is very encouraging and portends very well for the dynamic growth of all of the work and the students and the classes and the entire Moysid. So I really think it's a special privilege to be here. We did speak, just by means of a minute review, we had four major topics that we deal with. The first topic we dealt with was relationship with Hashem, something that's very, very critical. We went into a lot of detail, a lot of ideas of how that can be implemented, introduced, and maintained and inspired in the classroom, and should be part of the language of the classroom. Too many people feel that that today, that the practice of Yahadus, of Orthodox Judaism, is sort of has marginalized Hashem, and it became very, very much about what we do, not who we're connected with. The second unit that we discussed, something which is critical for Rebbeim and Moros, and that is, of course, relationship with the students. The relationship is the conduit through which your message, your inspiration, your ideas, your influence is given over to the students. When there's no relationship, especially when there's rules with no relationship, R, how do we say? R minus R equals R. Rules minus relationship equals rebellion. So you're certainly not going to get receptive students if there's no relationship. And if there is a relationship, you have an entirely different level of influence just by dint of the fact that we're friends. Getting into it, a teacher should be a friend. And yeah, a teacher should be a friend and a teacher, but that's besides the point. Okay, that was the second unit that we discussed. And today, we're here to discuss another unit. It's a discussion that probably takes at least two sessions, but we'll do the first today, and we'll see where we go from there. And that is clarifying the truth of Torah Misinai to our students. It's a easy but difficult topic. It's easy because the information is really very simple. The difficulty lies in the psychological resistance that exists by many people for many different reasons. And unless we understand what I like to call the psychology of Emunah, the psychology behind either the receptivity or the negativity, unless we understand that, we really can't convey the truth of Torah Misinai in any way that's going to be lasting. It just so happens that a therapist shared with me an issue that he's dealing with. An individual, person, intelligent man, with a very religious wife and children and yeshivas and everything normal. He himself says he doesn't believe in anything. They managed to have a good marriage, and unfortunately, I mean, I guess on a certain level fortunately, but unfortunately, there's many such situations today that I'm aware of, and I, you know, just extrapolate from that it's become more and more of a problem. In my day, when I was a kid, I remember such things. I had friends who one parent was religious and one wasn't, but those were days that we lived in a different world in those days. But today, it should be less common. It has been less common. It's getting, unfortunately, more common in recent years. And anyway, so this individual is coming up with all kinds of ideas and proofs and rationalizations and insights, and all just to prove to himself, he's not convincing anybody else, prove to himself in a way that's totally irrational that there can't be a God, there can't be a religion, the Torah is made up, and all the works that these people talk. And he just stays together. He says he has a wonderful marriage, and he loves his children, and Shabbos and Yom Tov is family time, but he actually goes after that. He does go, whatever it is. Okay, fine. So I think that it's an example that points out the need for this discussion and really the underlying problem with which we're dealing. In this particular situation, we are not dealing with a man who has come to a rational conclusion that there is no God, or there is no Torah Mesinai, or everything was man-made, or whatever his conclusions may be. It's not rational. He doesn't even present rationally. Anyone who listens to him hears that, what was he talking about? What is he accepting as reality? Things that are so bizarre, and rejecting as reality things that make so much sense. Obviously, there's something going on underneath. And when the therapist digs a little bit, or dug a little bit, they begin to see what happened in his childhood, and what type of abuse he may have suffered, and this and that, whatever the situation may be. And that's really the key. So, comes out as follows. You could tell me, well, if the main problem with people that are going off the derech, and this is also a yeshiva background, a very, you know, from family, went to good schools or the works. If the main problem is emotionally and psychologically, then what do I want from you people? We should be talking to therapists. We shouldn't be talking to teachers. What does it make a difference what we're going to do? Things are going to happen. They're going to have their emotional, psychological problems, and that's it. They're going to go off the derech. So what can we do about it now? Well, the answer is very simple. The stronger the foundation of the recognition of Torah Mesinai, and not only its truth, but its benefits to my life, it as a major and maybe only source of true happiness, the more those ideas are implanted and are clearly understood by our students, then even when they face the dangers of life and the sometimes tragic situations that befall them, they'll be much more, very much more, sometimes totally, sometimes partially, but immunized. They'll be ready to face these things because they have positive experiences underlying it. So if I have a positive connection, and if I have a clear understanding, and if I have a comfort level that's soothing, and I recognize that this is a source of true happiness, then when the things happen later, I have different tools with which to fight. I'm not necessarily so quickly going to reject everything. In fact, I won't reject everything so quickly, because it's been so clear to me and so meaningful to me and so satisfying to me that I don't want to reject it. When something was not so satisfying, I heard, I understood, I was a good boy, I listened to what the teacher, what the Rebbe had to say, I followed, I did, I davened, I learned, I did mitzvahs, but you know, I didn't really appreciate what I was doing. I didn't understand why. I didn't understand, couldn't articulate with confidence why this is the Dvar Hashem, why this is Torah Mesinai, and I certainly don't understand really how this is going to benefit my life. So then when things get shaken up, I find the exit. I leave. I'm out of here. But the stronger the basis that we have, the more difficult that will be, and the more tools that this individual will have to cope with the challenges that may face them later on in life. Therefore, I think what we're doing here is very important, because the stronger the message that we can have our students internalize, the more fortified they will be to face whatever might happen to them later. And so therefore, I think that this is an important discussion. Okay, let's begin. Some people think that, oh, come on, we know this already. We know everything. What are you going to tell me? That there's a creator in the world, that there's Hashgacha Protius, Hashem takes care of everything, that he gave a Torah at Sinai. I know. We know. We heard it. We heard it in the first grade, the second grade, the third grade, the fourth grade. Again in junior high school? And then again, Vita, what's going on? Well, there's a precedent for that. Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of his life, when he gathered in Parshas Veschanon, continues into Parshas Ekev, when he's talking to Klal Yisrael and reviewing in Sefer Dvorim all of the events of the past, in the middle of the whole discussion, he says as follows. V'yodato hayoim, you know it this day. V'hashevoiso elevovecha, and return it. The Targum says, usesuv lelibach, return it to your heart. Ki Hashem hu elokim b'shamayim imal v'aloritz mitochas ein oid. Talking to Klal Yisrael. Talking to people who just had mon for breakfast. Talking to the Dordeo that stood, or their parents stood, maybe they were little children, some of them, because this is the end of the 40 years, stood at Har Sinai. They saw the mon coming every day for 40 years. They lived in the air-conditioned condition of the Ananiya Kovid and the Amud Esh warming them at night. They lived lives of miracles, miraculous living, unprecedented and unreplicated in all of history. And you're telling these people, return it to your heart, Hashem Elokim. How could it get lost? What's there to return? There's nothing to return, it's there. The Teretz is, obviously, that when it comes to Emuna, even to those people who saw, some of them even went through the Yamsuf, their parents certainly did. They heard Hashem speaking directly to them. That saw all the years of 40 years of Mifsim, Nisim, and Niflois to survive miraculously in a Midbar Shmoma. And we still have to tell them, got to get it back into your heart. It slips away. The heart is very tricky. The heart has a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. And the heart, the Yetzer Hara tries to confuse us. Confuse who? Confuse the people that live these events. No, no, but well, I don't know, maybe Hashem Elokim. If the Dordeo needs that reinforcement, who can say that we don't? Who can say that our students don't? Who can say that even if they knew something in the first and second and third and fourth and fifth grade, that they don't have to know it again and again, deeper and deeper as their intelligence matures to be able to understand it better and better? Because the Dordeo had to review again Vashivo Yisrael Vovecho, and not even small details. Ki Hashem Hu Elokim. That also could be lost, even to that generation. So we're dealing with something that's very important. And to bring it down to modern world, because many people will say, oh, you're deriving from a posuk. It says in the posuk. I'm not sure what the objection would be. Reb Moshe Feinstein writes in a tshuva, when it talks about Shemitah, and you know the famous issue, Rashi says, it says, Vayidav Hashem el Moshe b'har Sinai leimor, and then it says the parasha of Shemitah. So Rashi is bothered. He brings from Chazal, Mayin Shemitah etzel har Sinai. Why does the Torah have to say b'har Sinai? Oh, it says, Vayidav Hashem el Moshe leimor. Vayidav Hashem el Moshe b'har Sinai leimor. So Chazal say that it comes to teach us, Rashi brings this, that just like Shemitah was given at har Sinai, so to all the other mitzvahs were given in Har Sinai. Asks Reb Moshe, and I saw it once in the Chassam Sofer too. It says that, why don't you say this by any other mitzvah? Why dafka to choose Shemitah to teach me that Ma Shemitah nitna b'Sinai? The Torah says Mi Shemitah, it's quite obvious. Because Shemitah, the Torah says, what if you're going to say, if I'm not going to be able to plant on the eighth year, what am I going to eat? How can we manage? What's going to be? Land lies fallow. I can't be a balabos. I have to be together with all the aniyim. So the Torah says that on the sixth year, the seventh year you can't do it. On the sixth year you will have a bumper crop. The land will give forth enough food for 3 years. For the sixth, for the seventh where you can't plant, or for the eighth until what you're planting grows. Who could make such a promise if not the Neisin HaTorah b'Har Sinai? So from Parshas Shemitah, we clearly see that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't have made this up himself. And Bechlal, if Moshe Rabbeinu would have made it up himself, so they asked the question, what are we going to eat? So he should have said, hey, you know what we'll do? We'll have half the land, we'll do it on 1 year, and half the land, we'll do it another year, we'll export, import. Or he could have said, we'll store like Yosef did. No. Ashona says, Tzivisi espirchosi bashona hashishis, v'oso sesoretz l'shleish hashonim. There'll be a special broch on the sixth year, and you have a 3 year bumper crop. Only the Neisin HaTorah b'Har Sinai, only the Rabbeinu Shleilim could make such a promise. That's therefore we see from here that Torah Misinai, and therefore we learn that all the other myths are also Misinai. So Reb Moshe says, you see from here, that even in previous generations, in the times of the Rishonim, in the times when they saw tzaddikim walking the face of the earth, they still needed this chizuk and emunah. That, because it seems the Torah wrote a special parasha for all generations, that we need this chizuk and emunah. Halachas kama today, when our students not only don't see such great tzaddikim walking the face of the earth every day of the week, but not only that, they're bombarded with every measure and every ounce of decadence that exists out there, and every foreign philosophy, and every stupidity, and every shigaon, every mishugas that a person makes up, it also becomes the world, the whole world knows it, and they're exposed to such things. So Allah has come of a kama that we have to strengthen the foundation for emunah. Now, there's a mistake that people make, and I think we should just do this very quickly. We're not talking about philosophizing. In fact, the Vilna Goin writes that you shouldn't read in the Sefer HaChovos HaLevavos, which is a very yesoidistic sefer, the Shar Yichud Hashem, which is the very beginning, a person shouldn't even study. So it's beyond us. It's all the philosophical proof, the existence of Hashem, and beyond us. It's philosophy. Elamai. So people say, okay, we don't talk about Emunah. But the Goin tells us what to do instead. He says, Elamai, you should substitute for that the Sefer HaKuzri HaRishayin, Shu Yokor Me'oid, and I think the Loshon is that it's the Ikrei Torah, the basis of Torah, is based on the arguments of the Kuzri. And that's basically what we talk today about Emunah. We talk about Mesorah, we talk about public revelation, we talk about accuracy of transmission of that revelation to the future generations. We show how all that was done, and in a very logical and rational way, and that's all we're talking about. We're not philosophizing. We're not going to prove. In fact, frankly, I don't even think we have to talk to anybody about proving the existence of Hashem. It's very simple. The Nesen HaTorah Bahar Sinai, He's the creator, that's all. If we know that the Torah was given by Har Sinai, we see this Torah, we know what that was, we know it's the voice, we know it's information that it has, we know, then that's all. I don't have to go, you know. So we're not talking philosophy, we're talking simple Kuzri, eyewitness testimony, millions of eyewitnesses, you know the story, we'll get to it a little bit more later on, maybe the next time. And millions of people saying, passing on to their children, not that there was an event, but that they saw the event. We'll discuss this more and more, and that's basically what we're talking about. There is such a thing as Emunah Pshuta, and many people talk about that. Unfortunately, the Emunah Pshuta is something that Lav Kol Odom Zocheh Lazeh. Not everybody achieves that. You know, there are people that live and see Hashem's Hashgocha Protis. They just see the Hashgochas Hashem in everything. There are others that don't. They're jaded. Society has so removed Hashem's name. There's science, there's medicine, there's all kinds of this. History, there's no Hashem. History is a sequence of cause and effect, events. Science is, of course, science. That's science. No Hashem over there. Medicine, oh, the doctor will tell you, you know, he knows exactly, he can take care of everything, he will heal you, he will... So, we sort of, Hashem's name has been dropped. I think it's still on the dollar bill, but nobody bothers to read dollar bills, you know. And nobody even uses dollar bills anymore. It's probably on the bigger bills also, but nobody even uses money anymore. So, you know, on Zelle or whatever other thing you have, I never saw that it says the name of Hashem. So it's completely forgotten. So we have to, and that's where the Emunah Pshuta comes from. It comes from learning. A level of learning which is so deep that you see this can only be authored by the Creator Himself. We don't have that deep learning today for the most part. There's a lot of superficiality. There's a lot of emphasis on accomplishing, covering ground, so to speak, learning a lot of material, a lot of information, which is very important. But it doesn't necessarily bring a person to the depth of learning where he sees no human being. No human being could have come up with this idea. Or the sensitivities of the Torah. The sensitivities of the Torah, the Bein Odom L'Chaveiroi, the Torah goes to such extreme. The Torah says that the Halacha says that if somebody had a hanging in their family, who knows when, You can't say, please hang up my coat. Hang up this, the Gemara's lotion is my the fish. Because the word, that's a noas dvorim, it conjures up some. The Altarim Slabotka has a shmuas, he says that in contracts, if you want to satisfy the obligation, if you didn't specify, then you have to satisfy not only the person's conscious needs, but even his subconscious needs. I don't want to go into that now, we don't have the time. But these are concepts that the world can't imagine. And today we're not overly exposed, maybe we're not exposed enough, or we're not exposed at all to some of these concepts, and therefore, so the Emunah Pshuta, like, nobody, who could invent such a thing? You know, Lashon Hara. Nobody ever could dream of it. Lashon Hara, you're not allowed to speak, you're not allowed to listen, you're not allowed to believe. There's two mitzvahs tmidius, a hishomer minega hatzoras, a love, guard yourself not to come to tzoras, 24 hours a day to be thinking, don't think other things too, but it's there. And zechores hashos Hashem elkecho leMiriam, remember what happened to Miriam. Such a complex web of efforts to make sure that we don't come to speak Lashon Hara, not to hurt a person, speak Lashon Hara, which might hurt eventually. This is a sensitive human being who pays attention can sense this. This is only divine, and there's an Emunah Pshuta. Unfortunately, today, most people don't get that exposure, don't have those sensitivities, don't get that feeling, and if they do, sometimes it's very temporary. So today we certainly believe, Reb Moshe wrote it beferish, and it's quite obvious, we need also rational explanations to be able to counter the negative influence, impulse, Yetzer Hara, that's going to try to blind people, especially when they're going through difficulties in life. And therefore, what we have to talk about is very important. Okay. We have some other problems that we have to deal with as well. And that makes it all the more important to be able to penetrate. Apathy. We live in a very apathetic generation. Most people don't care about anything. And it's very sad because it infiltrates our camp as well. And therefore we have to have something more than just, yeah, I heard it. Who cares? It just rolls right off my back. It's nothing matters. It's like nobody cares. Like, I don't know, I'm here, I gotta be here until I'm not here anymore, and like maybe just to have fun. But in terms of anything real, we don't have a generation of philosophers who try to ponder the cosmos and figure out why they existed in the world. What's their purpose? And nobody cares, my purpose, it's all. So Mamela, we have to implant in our youth a deeper appreciation of Torah Sinai, of their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the purpose of life, in order for that to really counter all the apathy that they're going to be exposed with later on. And we know that everybody is exposed. Anyone who thinks that we can filter out the outside influence is poshut naive. Naive. We can't do it. We can try, and we must try. We have to do the best we can to try, and no effort should be spared to try. But after everything is said and done, we're surrounded, we're bombarded. It's, so to speak, it's almost in the air that we breathe and in the water that we drink. And Mamela, we have to be able to strengthen our students. Something else that has always been an issue, but it's an issue as well today. In any academic environment, we train our students to think. When we learn Gemara, that's all about thinking. Yes, there's reading too. That's a big problem that we have today. That's besides the point. But it's thinking, critical thinking. Do the same when we learn Chumash and when we learn Novi, and challenge them, the question, what's Rashi talking about? Where does he get it from? How does he see it? How does he know it? It's critical thinking. It's part of the conversation. Now, when you teach a child to think critically, you create a monster. Oh, critical thinking. Well, how do I know? I'm very fortunate. I mean, I feel very fortunate. When I was about 15 years old, all of a sudden, I don't know if it was such critical thinking, but it popped into my head, how do I know what happened at Har Sinai? Now, you shouldn't present this. I'm assuming I'm not going to shake anyone's belief system up by even mentioning that word. I don't think it's in the classroom. Maybe you shouldn't do that. But you people look to me like you can handle it, okay? So I hope. Well, what do you say? Yeah,
someone
for
asks,
sure.
Some student every year asks that.
No, I understand, but you shouldn't ask it, okay? You should be able to answer it, but you shouldn't be the one to ask it. But anyway, so it's eingefallen. All of a sudden, I was at 15, I remember. How do I know? I don't really know. And I didn't know what to do. It was the summertime. I didn't really have anyone to ask either. So, but I had the good fortune, Mamash, I thank Hashem, I had just read a short biography of the Vilna Gaon. It was about a 70-page book. And it fascinated me, the sheer brilliance. So I said to myself, the Gaon was so brilliant. He could think of every question I did, especially this deep question of how do I know? And he continued to be the Vilna Gaon. I'll continue on, at least for a while, until I can get some answers. But we have to realize that they're going to have questions. And this answer that I answered myself is a very nice emotionally, I would call it an emotional band-aid. Temporarily, I got through. I still davened Mincha and Ma'ariv that day, and I didn't throw away the yarmulke, the tzitzis, and I continued along the course. Over the Maisa, that's not enough, because emotions ebb and flow. Emotions come and go. Emotions are not enough. We have to have emotional connection and an emotional feeling and an intellectual underpinning, intellectual understanding and background. Okay, so therefore we see that we certainly need to do both. Now, the problem is like this. Many people will just say, let's talk proofs. All right? That's the topic of today. Well, it's not. But let's talk proofs. I'm going to prove to you. So I don't know about your ego, but I know about my ego. The minute you say to me, you're going to prove something to me, I say to myself, oh, no, you won't. There's a natural resistance to confrontation with the truth. It's just a natural. The truth puts me in a corner, and I can't move. I'm locked in because, like this, there's no truth. You know, like every man has his own truth. Say whatever you want. And you see that today in politics. Mamish, everybody's saying the truth. All a bunch of liars. You know, so what's going on there? And it's even worse than that. I'll tell you once, I did a very unscientific study in a junior high school in San Diego. I asked a question to a group of junior high school students. I said, mention for me all of the different traits of character that exist. And they mentioned kindness, and they mentioned rachmonis, and they mentioned patience, and they mentioned forgiveness, and they mentioned everything. Except one word nobody mentioned. Until the Menahel himself said, I said, give me, there's something you missed. And the Menahel was the only one who comes and says, yeah, they didn't say the word truth. People are afraid of the truth. The truth is limiting, the truth is constricting, the truth is threatening, and you're going to prove something to me? I would like to say, P-R-O-V-E. I was going to say proof is a four-letter word, but it's really five. But Lemaisa, don't prove anything to anybody, because that will be the first nail in the coffin. That will be the first step that you make to convince them otherwise. So proof is a harsh word. And if we come along, and many people do come along with these arguments, well, we're arguing to a resistant, to a naturally resistant audience. We're arguing to an audience who it suits them better emotionally not to accept this proof. So they have the ego that says, I don't want to accept proof, and they have the natural sense of being unburdened and not to want to be shackled by the proof, by the truth. So mainly you have resistance. So the first thing before we even talk about any proof, or we never say the word, it's a bad word, but we show them information which is convincing and compelling. Shouldn't even say compelling. Keep it low, low key, understatement is much more, penetrates much more to a person's thinking than overstatement. And again, shouldn't get as excited as I get now also. So very calm, you know, like a funny thing happened to me on the way to the office. You know, when you talk about it like, you know, there's like a history class, like, you know, ancient history, like, you know, nothing to get excited about, just intellectual. So so we certainly have to do what we can to create a more receptive audience. And those, unfortunately, when people do that proof kind of stuff and they give it without the basis of understanding the psychology of resistance, I like to say it's they've immunized their students to be able to resist later on. Because, oh, I've been there, done that. I heard that already. I survived it. You gave me all these proofs, don't use the word, and I still go on with my life. I still do a cold over also, I do whatever I want. So, once you survive, if you survive an illness, you have antibodies. Now there's resistance. Now you tell me this stuff the next time in a much better way. Oh no, I learned how to do it the proper way with psychology, with it. Come on. You know, it's already too late. So you have to be very, very careful to work to understand the psychology before we do anything. So the first point is, as we said, the nature of the human being is to be free. That's why we get so much schar for being burdened, for accepting the directives that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put upon us, albeit that they're all for our benefit, but we still get credit for it, because even though it's for my benefit, there's a natural resistance. We really want to be free. We misunderstand freedom, that's true, and maybe by helping people to understand freedom, Chazal say, Ein lecho ben chayrin al misha isik bat Torah. The only ben chayrin is one who's isik in Torah. Why? Because the Torah gives you the mood and the tools with which to control yourself. You're not a ben chayrin if you're under the control of your desires. That's not free. I can't control myself. People have dieting problems. They're free? Not when they pass a refrigerator. No, not when they pass the kitchen. They're not free, because it just draws me. So that's not freedom. Ein lecho misha is bad. Oh, you pass a tray for the same thing that you have in your kitchen, you pass a tray for bakery or whatever. There's nothing drawing you. I mean, I hope there shouldn't be. Maybe there should be, I don't know. But we still don't do it. But I'm not drawn to it because it's out. But I want. I'm constantly want. Okay, so we know that we're fighting against that. Now, we would love to have not only our audience not resisting the truth, Torah Misinai and all of Yahadus, but we would love them to be in a position where they want it. If they want it, then we have a receptive, and maybe we'd even call them, although again it's not a nice word, a captive audience. Because everybody knows in sales, you don't come and tell a person, I'm going to sell you something that I think you'll really want. You come and tell him, this is what you've been looking for all along. I'm just giving you, you know, what you've been searching for. I'm giving you what you want, not I'm creating nuance. Creating nuance is a whole different metamorphosis that has to happen in the person. This is what you want. Here it is. I got it. So we want an audience that wants, that desires, that craves. How do we get that? It's not necessarily natural. Now, I take that back. That was not true. Subconsciously, it's natural. Every Jew craves truth. Every Jew craves Torah Misinai. Every Jew craves a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the question is, under how many layers of nonsense and schmutz and decadence and insanity and who knows what else? It's buried. So we have to be able to bring it out. We have to be able to free it from the shackles and the debris that covers it, and, you know, make it come alive again. So it's there, but we have to evoke it. How do we do that? How do we evoke the urge for truth? If we could come to a situation where people would be, could you please tell me the truth? Tell me, I want to know, tell me the purpose for which we're created. Tell me how we know that this is the purpose which the Creator created us for. Tell me, I beg you, please, I know I need it for my life. I know it's the only thing that will make me happy. I'm looking for it, I've been looking all over for it. Then you'll be able to listen to A.B. Rottenberg, what you're looking for is right there at your door. But until I look for it, it could be right there at my door, I could trip on it, and I wouldn't even know that it exists. So how do we do that? Now, that's, I could say, a little facetiously, that's your challenge, that's your problem, you know, figure out a way. I could just maybe give some suggestions as how it might be done. There are two stories that I like to tell, which I think evoke it. Before I do that, in our world today, when the issues that are confusing, there's an abortion issue, there's the issues that go on in Eretz Yisrael between Israel and the Palestinians, there are moral issues, capital punishment, there are, all of these issues really beg for an urge for truth. Because, like, how do you know? There's this argument, there's that argument. You know, capital punishment. You could argue and say, hey, that's a brilliant thing. A society without it can't survive because there's nothing to be afraid of. On the other hand, you could say, who's going to decide that this person should be killed? A group of people that probably can't even read? Well, maybe that's one of the requirements to be on the jury. I don't know. I doubt it. So, I don't know. What do you do? And issues like this evoke an urge for truth, because when you have an opportunity, when you see something, something in the news, something that you're discussing, say, hey, wow, how do you figure that out? A question like that could be very eye-opening in terms of an urge for truth. How are we supposed to know? What do you mean? Ah, you know how we're supposed to know? We have a directive from the Bo'erei Olam. Ah, now all of a sudden, because I'm confused and I see there's a need for truth and there's no way to find it, I'm already more receptive, more looking to listen to what you have to say. Well, that's one area. But I'd like to give two stories which probably never happened. Maybe they did. I don't know. I don't think it matters. A man brings home a diamond for his wife that the Queen of England didn't have such a diamond. It's mamish. She can't even lift a hand. It's so big, it's so beautiful, it's so pure, it's so heavy. Not shy. She's, of course, thrilled. Her husband is not shy to do no wrong. He brings home, he did one thing wrong. He brought home a friend who's a diamond dealer. And, of course, she shoved it in his face to look at. And he said, let me see that. I got to see, that's amazing. And he took a look. This is the most amazing, pure piece of cubic zirconia that I ever saw in my life. And she chalishes, she faints. And they revive her. My diamond! Faints again. Again, two, three times. Finally, he says, lady, listen to me. No one will ever know the difference. Just don't show it to a guy like me, up front, up close, and everyone else there. But it's not real. Who cares? Nobody will ever know. Even a diamond, which no one could know, if it's not real, something's missing. I don't want things. We want something. Human beings, we were created, despite all the resistance to reality and to truth, we also have a great affinity for it. We want it. I want it to be real. I don't want costume jewelry. I don't want junk. I don't want to fool people. I want the real thing. One. Another story. This guy meets a woman and he wants to marry her. He finds out that he's only marrying her for her money. She's an heir to mega bucks. And he goes over to the guy and he says, I'll get out of here. Don't you dare get away from my sister. He says, wait a minute. He says, I'm an actor. I do major roles in Hollywood. She'll never know that I married her for her money. I will wine her and dine her and the works. The brother, I don't know, some fool, backed off, let him marry this sister. 50 years of marital bliss, wining and dining her with her credit cards, of course, and She was the happiest woman in the world. What a wonderful husband I have. He's on his deathbed, and I don't know, maybe, I think it was, the story goes, he wasn't Jewish, and he felt he had to confess. So he calls her in, and he says, I just want to confess and tell you, I married you for your money, I never loved you, every nice word I said was a lie, and then he dies. She lives for 3 more months, and she passes away. Question. And when I challenge a group with this, I say, if you give the wrong answer, there's a consequence. Okay? Did this woman live 50 years of marital bliss and 3 months of misery? Or in those 3 months of misery, retroactively, it removed any pleasure that she ever had for those 50 years of marriage? And of course, I say, if you give me the wrong answer, which is, of course, you're afraid. The consequence is I have a shidduch for you like that. That you'll never know. You'll never know until the end. Nobody wants that. Everybody craves for genuinity in diamonds and certainly in human relationships. Alachas kama v'kama in life, in meaning, in purpose. So if you can manage to share like stories like this or evoke this urge for truth, then you have an audience that's receptive to what you're teaching. Then they're looking for to they want to believe what you're telling them. They want to accept what you're telling them. Not only through by dint of the fact that you have a close relationship with them, but by dint of the fact that you've created a receptive craving audience. They are craving for what you have to give them. And once you have that craving audience, it's a different world. Then your the receptivity, your ability to influence and to convince and to plant serious ideas which can remain will be, yes, I'm sorry.
Does Ruff think that sixth graders are mature enough to start? Like how would, what kind of like examples or like how would a sixth grader be able to start?
So one of the advantages, I alluded to it a few moments ago, that I have is I'm giving the theory. Okay, how to apply it to the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, you know, that I leave to the professionals. I don't have too much experience with 6th graders, but I think there are ways. Just, I mean, we'll do some more, but I think even a story like this, they can understand a story like that. They can understand, I don't know if you want to talk about this marriage situation, marrying for money, but they can understand the diamonds. Yeah, things have to be genuine. People want genuine. You know, and they can understand it, and especially if you give a consequence, you know, then they really understand. They say, I'm going to introduce you to someone you'll marry, and for 50 years you'll have marital bliss, and then you'll find out that they hated your guts the whole time. Yes, you want what?
Can we get an autograph? A real or a fake autograph?
What's that? Oh, yeah, fake, that's right. Okay, oh, see, that's it. It's the classroom people on that level that have to know how to do that. I apologize, I don't know how to do that. That's why my life is easier than your life. But anyway, that's the story. Okay, so let's leave that. Let's move on a little bit. Now, if we wanted to, what's our goal? According to what we've been talking now, what is our goal in trying to be mechazik, this understanding and appreciation for Torah Misinai? What is our goal? I would say that our goal is can be defined in two words. The Torah is true and the Torah is good. It's beneficial, it's a source of happiness, and it's true. And that combination is all powerful. Why? Because if I don't know it's good for me, as we mentioned, then I don't want to hear the truth. I'm resisting the truth. I'm not interested in the truth. So you won't get me. Elamai. So I have to know that it's good in order to be willing to hear and to accept the truth. Well, what if I just know that it's good and I don't know that it's true? Let's say you never shared with me the truth, just how good, how wonderful. Well, the problem is something else. This is wonderful. I'm having a blast. This is so much fun. I'm so happy. Everything's great. And a couple of years later, I wake up and say, hey, maybe there's something out there that'll make me more happy. I'm going to go take a trip now. Bye-bye. I'm off to India, I'm off to who knows where, you know. I'm going to see what I can find. But if I know that it makes me happy, and I know that it's real, I ain't gone nowhere. There's no place I want to go because I have everything. And if you question the need for this, I refer you to what we say. The Gemara says, Emes v'yatziv d'raisa. Every day we say Emes. The Torah is Torah. Kabbalah's HaTorah, Yitzias Mitzrayim, is Emes. V'yatziv v'nachoyin v'kayom v'yoshor v'ne'emon. That's in terms of truth. V'ohu v'chovi v'nechmod v'noim. I don't know how that got in there. V'ader m'sukon m'kubol v'toy v'yofeh. The Torah is true, and it's beautiful, and it's precious, and it's sweet. It's delicious. When you have that combination, then you got it made. So we have to be able to convey that. Now, part of the way we convey that is by elucidating, explaining the benefits of the mitzvahs. Because this is a very important point that we have to keep in mind. Our students do not necessarily see mitzvahs as benefit. They see them as annoyances. They see them as pain. They see them as pressure. And even those that like it, but sometimes the pressure catches up with the joy. At the third and the fourth and the fifth grade, I thought it was fun. By the sixth grade, when I've been introduced to other funds, I think it's less fun. By the seventh grade already, I'm already halfway out of here. By the eighth grade, forget it. So they have to have that sense. Sefer HaChinuch gives Tam v'Toeles on every mitzvah. And he says he's afraid on one mitzvah in Vayikra, Kol Sorah v'Chol Dvash Leisaktiru Isha LaHashem. He's afraid if he doesn't give Tam v'Toeles, he's afraid that the Torah will appear as Sefer Chosum, like a closed book, and he's afraid his kid and his friends will just go off the derech. Pen yivatu behem mitukach b'narusam yanichem lo'olam v'yeluchu lehevel. They could just get a kick, they're going to rebel, and they'll forsake it forever. He was a Rishon, he lived 500 years ago in a sane world. And also he gave Kamat Velas for the other mitzvahs. He was afraid if he doesn't write on one, they might turn them off, or it'll be an excuse to turn off for everything else. The Ralbag is very interesting in the Toelius in Parshas Lech Lecha, says if you wish to convince a loved one, now there's already that loving relationship, which is already a conduit to convince, to do something that's bizar umuzar, that's painful and bizarre. Don't tell him what it is. First, tell him the benefits. And the cheshek for the benefits will create a receptivity to what's painful and strange. Where do we learn this from? From Avram Avinu with the Bris Milah. Avram Avinu, Hashem did not tell him that there's a knife involved. First, he told him, enter into this covenant with me, and then you're going to have Eretz Yisroel and Dyrus and this. And only then did he say, here's the knife. It could have affected an Avram Avinu had he first given him the knife and then told him the benefits. So it's very important if we create an environment where we appreciate the benefits. Okay, now I'd like to talk for a few moments that we have left about the benefits. The major benefit in life, the thing that everyone wants most in life, any group that you will ask will tell you after they get rid of the jokes and the nonsense, everybody wants to be happy. That is the universal craving. Everyone wants to be happy. Problem is, of course, in our society, where it's not a very happy place, if you look at any of the rates, you know, the suicide rates and divorce rates and the substance abuse rates, and the rates that mental health professionals can charge, no offense to anybody. So we're not doing too well on the happiness. Yet we're searching for happiness. More money is spent on pursuit of happiness than anything else. How you talking? There is this bullshit. We don't know what it is. Our society has lied to us. And you have to correct that lie to your students. Pleasure does not equal happiness. In fact, there's an inverse relationship. Because the more you get pleasure from the outside, the more you feel empty on the inside. Why? Because the definition of happiness is, David HaMelech said, Achash shu'alti me'es Hashem o'is ha'vakesh, we say it in the thing, Shivti be'es Hashem kol yumei chayai. And what did he say about one who sits be'es Hashem? Ashrei yoshvei be'secho. Osher. Aleph shin resh is the shirish, happiness. What's the shirish? Ishur, validation. Happiness is defined as feeling good about oneself. If I feel good about myself, I'm happy. Pleasure from the outside doesn't make me feel good about myself. It makes me feel bad about myself. I need all of this outside extra intake in order to get through the day. That means I don't feel good. If I can't feel good about myself, I don't need anything. Everything's fine. So that's the yisod. The happiness is about feeling good about oneself, not pleasure. And the more you pursue pleasure, the more you undermine the happiness. It's also very important, just for the record. It's a question at some point that's good to ask your students. You had a delicious dinner, the best steak that you ever tasted. Now it's 2 weeks later. Do you have a pleasurable memory or a memory of a pleasure? No consequence if you get the wrong answer on this one. A pleasurable memory or a memory of a pleasure?
The difference is
a pleasurable memory is of having pleasure now. A memory of a pleasure means I remember there was a pleasure, right? Now I have nothing. And it's clear that it's only the memory of a pleasure. So that means all of the material pleasures that I have don't give me pleasure now. In fact, they give me frustration because I really want more. I love to tell the story. I don't even have much time left, but I love to tell the story about my introduction many years ago in Miami to Pina Colada. Forgive me for sharing my drinking problems with you. Anyway, I never knew what that was. And someone that we were out for dinner with someone. I liked it. Sarah's, a dairy restaurant, used to be in Miami. Fine. After that, I liked pina colada, so we went to Simcha someplace. Yeah, try pina colada. Nah, they don't know how to make it. I remember Marina Del Rey, they don't know how to make pina colada here. They don't know how to make, nobody knows how to make. Then I get back 4 years later to Sarah's. First thing I order is the pina colada. Sarah doesn't know how to make pina colada either. How come? What happened? Push it. The first time you have a pleasure, the sensitivity is high. You never had this before. So it's, every time after that, the sensitivity is dulled. So you even need more stimulus to get to the same level of pleasure. But that's only a halbitzor. It's only half the problem. The other half the problem is that the memory exaggerates the pleasure. When you have a pleasure, because of the frustration that we have that the pleasure doesn't last, we're constantly exaggerating in our mind so you're competing with a diminished sensitivity with an increased, enhanced memory, a false enhanced memory. So what do you have? Frustration. So they have to know this, that the pleasures of the world have to come in more than just the true pleasure. Happiness has to come in more than just the outside pleasure. Now, there's something else they have to learn. As we mentioned before, Ein Lecho Ben Chayre, Le Misha Isik Batera. The pleasure of self-control is one of the most validating pleasures. Think about it. To control oneself. You know, it's like, in fact, it's like the crowning glory almost of the human being over the animals. Animals don't have control. They could be conditioned maybe to a certain extent, but I have the ability to decide what's right and to do it. And that makes me feel, if happiness is about feeling good about oneself, validation, ishur, the asher, the passport, that's validation. If it's about validation, if I have a Torah that can give me the tools to control myself, wow, I have something that's so unique, that's so special. And then, just two more things. To feel valid, I have to know that I have a purpose. The most invalidating feeling is I have no purpose in life. If a therapist has a client walking into their office and saying, "Doc, I have no purpose in living," I would recommend a suicide watch, because there's no purpose. Now, what if I have the wrong purpose? Oy vey, that's almost as bad. Maybe that's worse. If I want to know the purpose of this piece of technology, I used to say I read the manual. Now you just Google it, but whatever. Okay? And I want to know the purpose that I'm living in this world. I don't want to be like one of those millions of people scurrying back and forth all day long for as many years as they're on the face of the earth and not having any idea what they're doing here. The manufacturer gave us a manual. I don't know if you can Google that manual, but whatever. He gave us a manual 3,335 years ago at Har Sinai. Now we know what our purpose is. And in that manual is the individual purpose for each person can find it. We have to explain how. The Chavos HaLvovos explains it. We judge by our talents and by our our leanings and by our interests and whatever it is, but each person can find, according to who he is, his purpose. The Torah is given, it fits everybody. And it's a sense. So then I can truly have a sense of meaning and purpose in my life. And the Mela now, I am ready. I'm craving, please. And I remember the experience at the seminars when we used to do these outreach seminars for not religious people. And when you talk about these things and you do it before they hear about Torah Misina, could you tell us the purpose already? Look, they can't wait to hear. Because you've evoked this desire. When you evoke this desire, it's very powerful. And I think that there's one other thing that people can appreciate when it comes to a desire, and that is the essence of the whole Torah is to refine human character, is to make us godly. That means that the purpose of the Torah is to elevate me to a godly state, to emulate and to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Wow, how good that feels. Imagine how Adam HaRishon felt when the Malachim started to say to him, Kodosh, Kodosh, Kodosh. When the Malachim Chazal say, they roasted meat for him, and the Malachim. Wow, because I am Adam HaRishon, Yitzhakapov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I was created, B'Tzelem Elohim. If we realize that we can emulate Hashem, that the Torah is all about, the Chazal say it's a Medrash Rabbo in Parshas Lech Lo, L'nitna HaMitzvos El Litzarif V'Enes Abriyos. What more can we ask for? Anyway, these are some ideas. I just want to suggest, I don't know if I ever gave these out. Did they ever get these? To each one? No? You have? Okay, so I'd like to, if you want, if you give me a number of people, I would send over these. They're very good. This one really is on each parsha. A lot of teachers use it just for a Dvar Torah, but it has two pieces on every parsha. Some vort, which is mechazek emunah in a backhanded way, and the other one, which gives what's called benefits and beliefs, benefits and belief, which shows the benefit of the mitzvah. So you're doing both. It's good and it's true. And this one has a lot of the psychology that we spoke about today, and a lot of other pieces how to deal with suffering, which I don't think we dealt with that a little bit. But we did. But it has a lot of this stuff here. So if you give me a number, I'll make sure that everybody gets this. If there are any questions and certainly any dissenting opinions. Oh, dissenting opinions, I'm out of here. Okay. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
It's just Lamaisa. What's the best answer when a kid asks, how do we know our sin happens?
Okay, so the best answer that I have for you is tune in next time I'm here.
Okay.
All right. If I'm not mistaken, that's the subject of the next. This was just, I feel that this discussion is more important than that discussion. That discussion, once you have this discussion, that discussion will be, very simple. Let me just make sure I'm right. Yeah, that's right. That's the next, that's section 6, yeah. So to do it now would be doing it injustice. However, there's beautiful stuff you could read up on that. Some of it is here. Uri Zohar's biography, I think they reprinted it recently. My Friends We Were Rob, chapters 11 and 12 is a very powerful presentation of that, and there are many other books that deal with that. Yes.
Is there too young of an age to talk about?
Just a little louder. What? I'll tell you. I don't know. Again, I'm not. That's not my field. But I can tell you a sense that I had two or three times sitting at the Shabbos table, and we have in the next room, but you see it from where I sit, a bathroom. And the bathroom door was open. And I asked one of my little grandchildren, 2 years old, 3 years old, could you please close the bathroom door? And I sensed the joy in that I have a mission. I have a purpose. And it's happened to me a few times. So I think younger kids can also. You know, of course. And what do you think, excuse me, when they're building with Lego, what they think they have a purpose. They're building, a bridge, the Empire State Building, whatever they build with those things. So I think they do. I think that's human. Now, of course, the more they can communicate, the more you can communicate it. But I believe so. I have the sense that there's a purpose. We have, what am I supposed to be doing? It's very, very, you know, there's a famous story about this guy who was on the plane and he was and sitting next to a goy and was taking off, tying his shoe and put on the right shoe, then put on the left shoe, then tied the left shoe. And the guy looks at him like as if he's a meshugana. And he's a little bit embarrassed, like the guy's asking, what are you doing? So he says, well, we have rules that tell us you put on the right first and then you tie the left because the left is more choshev in time because of the tefillin and the right is more choshev. The guy says, wow, what an amazing religion that you have directives on how to live your life. Every step of the way has a meaning and has purpose. It's a very, there's another story they tell also about a rabbi who was learning halacha. And there's a big, big gvir in the community, the biggest supporter. And he begged him to come to the shir, and he never comes. One day he walks in, and they're learning about Hilchas Beis HaKise. What should I do? Should I move on? Or should I let this guy hear what we're talking about here? Beidish, he didn't know what to do. He says, no, I'm going to do what's right. I'm continuing to learn. That's all. The guy walks over to him later. He thought, uh-oh, here it comes. He says, I never knew. This is such an amazing religion. It even gives us directives how to conduct ourselves in the bathroom. Oh. That's, I think, people have a sense of that too, if it's done in a positive way. Okay, thank you very much. I wish Hatzlocha to everybody. And Yirotzen Shetishra Shechina B'Masi Yedeichem.